Some of it's to be announced, and you know, FET is not effective field theory, it's just a very simple field effect transistor. So I got interested in this like a couple of years ago, some time, and I just find it, you know, totally crazy that it was really impossible to pull out a number for temperature dependence or density dependence or the viscosity of an electron liquid in a small solid state device. So that you can measure the viscosity of helium-3, helium-4, this has been done for a long time, of course. You can measure the viscosity. Even I was reading these papers on EDS CFT without understanding anything, but I understood that people do elliptical flow measurements to get even, you know, a hint of what is the viscosity of a quark gluon plasma. And then I saw the papers by Thomas that have been already cited earlier in this workshop. Jay Thomas, this is at Duke in North Carolina, which by doing, you know, breathing mode or expansion experiments of a cold atom cloud, a strongly interacting cold atom cloud, you know, you could measure the viscosity of the lithium 6, a nanokelvin temperature scale, and you know. So that's really the motivation. And so what is the viscosity of an electron liquid in a small solid state device? And I was mentioning also that, you know, honey has been mentioned, and you know, I love wine. I just am a professional wine sommelier. That's what I did for 1.5 years, essentially. It was very extremely interesting. And so viscosity and, in fact, even evaporative cooling near the interface between solutions of water and ethanol and glass are extremely interesting for understanding these wine tears. And so the problem is very old. Thomson is the only one that said something which makes sense, and then Marangoni. But there's still a lot to do. And so now, you know, you can buy on the market stuff to measure the viscosity of wine. I've not asked my experimental colleagues to do that, but I will do that in the next few weeks. Okay. So this was would not be possible without this new institute where I moved. So the affiliation was spelled wrong, and it's the only thing that didn't work coming here. It's just the affiliation that was not wrong. The rest, it's absolutely amazing. So this is Istituto Italiano di Tecnologia. I cannot say it in English because it has been registered with the Italian name. In English, of course, it's Italian Institute of Technology. It's based on a one-dimensional city up in the north of Italy. It's Genova, really literally, you know, one-dimensional city, Genova, right in Liguria. And although I still live in Pisa, so I commute back and forth between Pisa and Genova. That's lots of fun. And this would definitely not have been possible without support of the, you know, biggest European project on two-dimensional materials started in 2013, which is called Graphene Flagship. Okay, so this was the undergrad thesis of Jacopo Torre at Scuola Normale in Pisa. And we have now a few more people working on it, like Francesco Pellegrino and Andrea Tomadin, and also Alessandro Principi, who is a postdoc with Misha Katznelson at Nijmegen, has been involved. And this would not be possible without extensive work done by the Manchester group, in Andre Geim's group. In particular, the measurements were done by Dennis Bandurin and Roshan Kumar on amazing samples by Moshe Ben Shalom and Greg Oton. So I'm going to talk a lot about these experiments, and this is more or less a list of papers that have appeared in the literature. I should say I'm the last one to talk about these papers. So we have seen the Harvard paper, and KC and Andy have given talks about that. We have seen the paper by Andrew McKenzie and this talk, and essentially it was a third paper in the same science issue, and that's what I'm going to talk about essentially today. And so this is the outline of the talk. I'm going to give a brief introduction more or less to where we are, and in terms of, you know, really sample quality, why it was possible to do these experiments in this very new second generation graphene samples. I'm going to talk a little bit about our very simple theoretical approach, and discuss these negative non-local resistances and current whirlpools, and how they enable you essentially to extract the viscosity as a function of carrier density and temperature in these two-dimensional electron liquids. And so I will give you then, you know, numbers for these viscosity as a function of density and temperature. There's lots to do. And of course, we have heard also this very nice talk by Leonid Levitov based on these and other papers earlier in the week. And Leonid is always very kind to me. He always uses this picture of when I was, 10 or 20 kilos less and much younger with no white hair. So that's the first picture I found on the web. No white hair of Leonid, and so that's I'm being equally kind. Okay, so let me say just a very very easy thing. This has been mentioned over and over in the conference. We do like two-dimensional electron system. I come originally from a little bit of gallium arsenide work, and so this is just just amazing for us, because essentially you put a little metallic control electrode near a two-dimensional electron system, and you form the simplest thing we study in high school, which is a parallel plate capacitor, right? So by applying just a voltage difference between the two-dimensional electron system, which by the way does not screen perfectly the electric field, and these control electrodes, you can induce charges. And so that's a new parameter. It's impossible to do a field effect, of course, in three-dimensional bulk systems. In these systems, it's amazing because you opens up parameter space, so you can probe quantities as a function of carrier density and not only as a function of temperature. And the usual interactions get stronger as you lower density, just because of long range Coulomb interactions. You like to work at low densities. Although this talk it will be in the ordinary simple Fermi liquid regime, so that's what I'm going to mention. Okay, and so the first thing you do when you have a new material, you try to flow current. Right. So this is the famous paper by the Manchester group. There is also even more important conceptual paper in PNAS, where this technique of mechanical exfoliation was carried out for layered materials, and this is not even single layer, but it was a few layer graphene, and they were able to flow current through it, so make contact and do electric field effect, and they discovered that it's an ambipolar or zero gap semiconductor. We have seen this over and over. This is a tight binding calculation, not very different from the one that a Canadian, Wallace did back in 1947 in this country. And it's a little bit more refined, but essentially you see that there are these, Dirac crossings and at the Fermi energy, which is the hexagonal contour in red, in pristine graphene in interstellar space, right? When you put it on a substrate, this charge transfer from the substrate, there's lots of dirty stuff that happens, but this is the ideal picture, and there's only one parameter in the Hamiltonian. It's not an effective mass technically. It's the Fermi velocity, which is roughly 300 times smaller than the speed of light. So this was one of the most influential papers in graphene field. This was done by Amir Jacobi and Jens Martin when Jens was at Harvard, and these are very poor spatial resolution, so it's only 150 nanometers spatial resolutions. These are a single electron transistor measurements by which they are very, they can measure very well electrostatic. The spatial resolution was not so good, but it shed light on an important problem, which is the fact that when you are at low densities in these very first generation samples, which were just graphene deposited on amorphous quartz silicon dioxide, you have charge paddles. So the length scale is not reliable here because it's huge. As I said, the spatial resolution is not so good. But the fact that you have density fluctuations in these order of magnitude, and so smearing of the Dirac point is essentially impossible to access intrinsic physics in these first generation samples. So stuff, as was already mentioned by KC, improved a lot when later on different people in the world, and particularly Corey Dean and other people also in Manchester, tried to just change substrate extremely easy. So there's been a really an amazing substrate, which is hexagonal boron nitride. This is just a wide band gap insulator, is almost lattice matched to graphene, 1.8% lattice mismatch. So when you put graphene on top of this, there's no strain. In fact, you form beautiful physics, Moiré patterns, very interesting optical properties, and the two guys really have married well. It's the most successful wedding in the history of human beings, in my opinion. and so these are STM experiments. So the experimental resolution is much better here, and you see what it was already mentioned. So you see that on all the first generation samples on silicon dioxide, you have paddles of the order of 20 nanometer with smearing of the Dirac point, which is a few hundreds of millielectron volts, while if you use HBN, hexagonal boron nitride, as a substrate, So you see the length scale here, paddles becomes extremely smooth, and that's the approximation Andy was doing, which is perfectly justified when you work at the neutrality point on this new generation of samples, and you see here the statistics of the how the Dirac point is shifting in space with a much sharper. Oh, this is just how the Dirac point is shifting in space. This is from STM, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So so the last frontier is just not only to put boron nitride underneath, but also above. These are called encapsulated samples. These were experiments pioneered by Corey Dean and Jim Hone at Columbia University, and many other works have been published by Manchester Group, by Pablo at MIT, Harvard, and there's now amazing samples also by Christoph Stampfer in Aachen, which are based on CVD graphene, so mass ton production is also possible. These very high quality samples in which you make a sandwich exactly, right? So it's a graphene in between boron nitride where the electron liquid is completely screened by imperfections. In fact, even you can make electrical contact to this very exotic, almost one-dimensional, that's the way they called edge contact. So you can measure essentially without the problems of measuring a contact resistance. So is absolutely amazing sample, so amazing that essentially you reach ideal conditions in which the electron liquid is only scattering off the intrinsic vibrations in plane acoustic phonons of graphene, and these are very well known. It's very well known, the electron phonon coupling constant, which is tiny. For experiments up to room temperature and beyond, you don't have to worry about optical phonons, which have a huge energy scale here, 200 MeV, just because the lattice, of course, it's extremely stiff. So, and you don't have to worry about the Lifshitz phonons, which are very soft, and they of course make problems in suspended samples. So paradoxically, these samples are even better than suspended samples. There was, a time in graphene physics where people were trying to eliminate crap from the bottom by suspended graphene. And paradoxically, of course, there are out-of-plane phonon vibrations, and these are these Lifshitz phonons, and those limit the mobility of the samples when you work at large temperatures. These encapsulated samples don't even have that problem, so it's absolutely amazing, to the point that you can really, at least asymptotically, as a function of carrier densities, for densities above 2 × 10^12, there's only one scattering mechanism which controls the C transport. It is not tau, but it's the mobility in centimeter squared per volt second. This very old data by Corey and other people in 2013 showing mobilities at room temperature which are unbelievable and impossible to get in gallium arsenide, as you are above 35 Kelvin in gallium arsenide, optical phonons kill you. So it's really absolutely amazing. New samples, in particular the ones we're studying this work, I'm going to talk about at the room temperature mobilities of 60,000, 70,000. So it's absolutely incredible for two-dimensional systems. I don't remember the number on top of my head. I mean, it's
2,000 meters per second. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so we have seen these inequalities over and over, so let me just rehearse a little bit, 1 second, so go through again. So that's a regime we are seeking. It's a regime in which the electron-electron mean free path is the shortest length scale. The problem, so I will be calling L the mean free path for momentum non-conserving collision, was LMC, LMR, I think, in the notation of ND, and the W is the width of the sample, which are standard rectangular all bars in these experiments, as I will show you. And interestingly, if you do optics, you have to be a little bit more careful. This work is about transport, but we are thinking with several people in the world on how to probe these things with photons. If you have AC fields, you have also make sure that that this inequality is satisfied with H bar omega is the photon energy and VF is Fermi velocity. And if you put numbers in, you have to work with terahertz light. So that's quite interesting. We do believe that there's hope to measure this. with photons too. So this was already discussed. I think it was Andy at this slide. It's a rule of thumb, like Ashcroft-Merman, simple estimate of how interactions, how important interactions are. This is the equivalent of the Arsa-Bess parameter, Bigness heights in an ordinary parabolic band electron liquid. So you compare the typical strength of Coulomb electron-electron interactions, which is long-ranged, 1 over some distance L, E squared divided by L, with the typical kinetic energy in this material, which is, you know, just Dirac, so it's linear, H bar VF divided by the same length scale. And so you see that this number, it's a constant, it does not depend on carrier density. That's very unusual, right? If you go in parabolic band systems, you can make coupling constants larger and larger just by lowering the density. Yeah, it's not so much so, and this is sensitive to the substrate, and that was already mentioned. This is a screening factor here, roughly, which is the average between the permittivity above and below graphene. So if you put numbers in, this fine structure constant is of the order of 0.9 or so for the experiments I'm going to talk about, and which is graphene encapsulated, as I said, in boron nitride in suspended sheets would even be 2.2 with the problems, however, I mentioned related to scattering off flexural phonons. So first thing first, it's, you know, you have to understand what is this scattering time for electron-electron collisions. And I will be working, for the reasons I mentioned, I will be working far away from the neutrality point, you know, the carrier density of the order of 10 to the 12, and deliberately that's what we decided to do, just to stay away from complications that Andy mentioned related to inhomogeneities, which I will not take into account microscopically in these calculations. So this is just, you know, we have seen more fancy diagrams. This is a textbook. It's encoded in every solid state code available in the world for any band structure person that does microscopic calculations. It's called GW in our field approximation. Very simple diagram, you know, bare propagator typically here without any self-consistency, no vertex corrections, and this, you know, the ring at the summation of all the RPA diagrams with simple bubbles, right? So that's essentially taking care about effective frequency-dependent screening, which in a conducting system, especially in two space dimensions, is very important. Very simple diagram to calculate within these approximations. This was done also by Shankar Dasarma and other people, and you know, we did this to celebrate a great friend of mine, and he was a professor at Purdue that passed away in 2012. We have this now book, and it was Giuliani, and if you have read the literature, Giuliani and John Quinn were the first people to calculate exactly the same thing for a parabolic 2D electron gas at the time Abrams and other people were working on the Rollo disorder. So you can do this calculation analytically and in the Fermi liquid, deep in the Fermi liquid regime for KBT much smaller than the Fermi energy. And it's in fact interesting, you can do these calculations, as I said, analytically. You discover that a collinear scattering with small momentum transfer Q equals zero completely dominates this rate for collisions between electrons. And in fact, Q equals zero, as you know, it's very well screened by the electron liquid. So quasi-particles in the dope system near embedded in the Fermi sea are very well screened. And what happens is that 1 over tau, in fact, does not depend, as you see, on the fine structure constant for KBT much smaller than EF. And then you get modulo this log correction, you get the usual T squared. So T squared log T, it's the rate of quasi-particle collisions. In a 2DAG, by the way, is more complicated parabolic bands because you have, you know, backscattering, 2KF scattering, which is completely forbidden here by the chiral nature of these Dirac-Weil fermions, okay? So you can put this on a computer if you are not happy with the KBT much smaller than EF. And this is just to make a point, if you do these calculations as a function of temperature for typical graphene densities, so the mean free path, I'm talking now about LEE, which is VF times tau, the mean free path for electron-electron collisions, although it's because of Pauli blocking, as it was discussed discussed extensively at this conference, grows as a function of temperature. For low temperatures, equally well, it decays fast, approximately like T squared for temperatures, for increasing temperatures. And these results show that you can have mean free path for electron-electron collisions, even in the doped Fermi liquid regime, which are about a couple of hundred nanometers, according to calculations, while near the Dirac point, you expect something of the order of tens of nanometers. So you have one order of magnitude, you know, less hydrodynamic behavior in the doped Fermi liquid regime, but still this is much smaller than the mean free path for momentum non-conserving collisions, which in a two-dimensional material goes like 1 over T as a function of temperature. So this, you know, it is a very large range of temperatures above liquid nitrogen temperatures, but in which the mean free path for electron-electron scattering is smaller than the mean free path for momentum non-conserving collisions and the sample size. And that's what really motivated us to look into this at non-cryogenic temperatures. And you know that once those inequalities are satisfied, these equations have already somehow been showed many, many times. You can use just conservation laws, you know, charge and energy modes are decoupled in the Fermi liquid regime, so I don't have to worry about the third hydrodynamic equation. I can worry just about conservation of charge, which is the continuity equation, and I can worry only about momentum conservation, and that's the Navier-Stokes equation. And this is exactly like in water, modulo the fact that you have to be careful here. Typical gradient pressure terms are, you know, parametrically small. You can put numbers in for these encapsulated samples because of nearby gates. So these terms are really not very important. And of course, you have to be careful about the electrostatics, as Leonid mentioned over and over. And this is the shear viscosity term, of course. And that's the way we model. This was already mentioned by Andy extensively. These are very simple Drudian, right? Aristotelic approach to momentum non-conserving collisions, whereby, you know, V dot is equal to 1 over minus 1 over tau times V, and that's what we are doing. Tau for us, it's a phenomenological parameter. If you want to do better, this was done by Andreev, Kivelson, and Spivak for a non-relativistic system, as also Andy mentioned. For example, this was done for a scalar potential, but as I said here, the most important scattering is acoustic form scattering. So this has not been done, as far as I understand, microscopically. We are very happy with just a simple 1 over tau model. Okay?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So we've seen that term several times this week, the 1 over tau term. So
yeah.
Is there a reason why momentum non-conservation should be proportional to momentum itself?
Well, you know, so we like this because if you switch everything off, right? If you switch off nonlinearities, convective nonlinearities, and all the other terms, you get our beloved Drude model. Right? So this was already mentioned. You get just conductivity, which is n squared tau divided by mass. In this case, the effective mass, and that's what we like. So this works extremely well in condensed matter. So we are very happy with that. But as I said, you just microscopically, if the disorder is smooth, you can treat it as gradient of scalar potential. You put it in your equations, and this was done by Andreev and other people. So
you can also say it's only in terms of gradient potential.
Yeah. Well, I think the models, like holographically, where sometimes you get the heat current instead
of... Yeah, exactly. You can work out exactly what appears there. You can break the translation centrifuge, you can work out the hydro. And in relativistic theories, you don't always get the momentum on the right-hand side that you finish the scale. At the equilibrium period, you get that, and then you get other fractions beyond the equilibrium.
But you're saying in the non-relativistic limit, that's
in the non-relativistic limit, that's probably what you
and so it's a nice Fermi surface, you're doped, those terms are totally irrelevant.
As far as in a perturbative expansion in 1 over tau, that's the leading term. And roughly speaking, at least from a transport perspective, I mean, any object that you, if you wanted to replace that with a different current, it would just change the proportionality coefficient at leading order. But yeah, I mean, it gets very messy to go to higher orders in general.
Thank you.
Okay, so I will be working in the linear response and steady state regime. So as we have seen earlier, so all these time derivatives disappear. And even in that limit, of course, this theory is very interesting, simply because it's non-local, right? So if you write the relation between current and the applied electric field is a non-local conductivity, sigma of Q and omega, simply because there is a Laplacian there, right? So even at that level, the theory is interesting. And the key word is non-local there. And so it's, you know, you do 1 plus 1, and usually it's 2, right? So there's not much that you can do. And in the sense that I would be talking about no local experiments precisely for that very simple reason, okay? So when you want to, you know, solve these equations, you have to choose some boundary conditions. This point was mentioned already by Leonid earlier in the week, and you can open Landau-Lifschitz and read what are the ordinary boundary conditions that people use in classical fluid mechanics. So you can have the no slip boundary conditions that were used by Leonid, velocity which is tangential to the walls of your electron container, which is your typically all bar, for example, must vanish. And otherwise, you can use the boundary conditions which are used for the surface of a liquid in a bucket, which are called no stress or free surface boundary conditions, in which you impose that the tangential component of the force exerted on the electron liquid from the boundary is zero. How do you choose between the two? Of course, you can solve the problems with two and then compare with the experiments, and I will tell you that there is, in our opinion, a simple answer, at least for the linear response regime we're working on. And then there are easy boundary conditions at the metallic electrodes if you want to really simulate the experimental samples, okay? So this is now, you know, the key point. We just want to measure you know, probe that you are in this regime, and you know, how do you do it, like in a real experiment, okay? So this was what I was trying to mention earlier. It's very well known that the viscosity controls the Q expansion of the transverse current response function, in general, the current response function. So it's pretty evident that you could, in theory, measure the viscosity, at least in the high frequency regime, by looking at lifetimes of collective modes in the electron liquid, right? So you can do a perturbative calculation in that case, just checking how the bare empty RPA bubble is dressed by electron-electron interactions. And the physics is quite simple. What happens is that a plasmon just decays intrinsically, if you go beyond RPA, by emitting two electron hole pairs, as you see in these diagrams. And that's the leading order in this diagrammatic expansion, and starts a second order in alpha, so technically, a second order in the strength of Coulomb interactions. And you can do large N, so out of all the mass of diagrams, of second order diagrams in Coulomb interaction, which you have in perturbation theory, you can select only the diagrams with largest number of bubbles. This calculation can be done analytically for small q, and you find that the plasmon acquires a lifetime, which goes like q squared, right? And you can compute this, and plasmons have been measured in these materials extremely well, and you can compute the lifetime as a function of carrier density. Turns out to be very small effect, because the viscosity at these large frequencies along the plasmon dispersion, which is much larger than VFQ, the threshold for electron hole excitations, is a small quantity. So in fact, the plasmon lifetime is dominated by, unfortunately, extrinsic effects, like precisely, you know, a plasmon decaying by exciting an electron hole pair and giving part of the energy and momentum to, for example, the lattice, okay? So those are absolutely dominant. And so this first attempt was absolutely hopeless, and that's where we started in 2013, okay? You know, it was a situation, you know, you go even more crazy and start thinking about totally, you know, stuff that cannot be done experimentally. So Corbino was an Italian, in fact, Sicilian, so we share the same origin. So it was, in fact, pretty much the only ministry that we had that made sense in Italy. So we're talking about in the 1920s or stuff like that, Orso Maria Corbino. All the rest of ministries for science have been totally terrible. So this guy invented what's very useful in quantum Hall physics. It's called Corbino disk geometry. So this is an annulus of your electron liquid here in light gray, and then there is the usual dielectric underneath, and has been a very useful device for you know, checking quantum Hall physics. And so we just thought to, you know, thread this Corbino disk by a time-dependent magnetic flux, because just by Faraday law, that's exactly gives you what you would like to probe shear modes, because it gives you a, you know, azimuthal electric field with a non-zero gradient along the radial direction, right? So you can imagine that observables you are going to compute in response to these time-varying, weakly time-varying electric, you know, flux are going to, you know, be sensitive to the viscosity. So this was the idea. And in fact, you can do these calculations, and in fact, you know, you can convert this AC signal, you can calculate the response of the electron liquid to this time-varying field, and you just have to measure a DC voltage, because the equations are nonlinear. All right, so if you take into account even the simple nonlinear coupling between the density and the velocity just in the mass conservation equation gives you a signal rectification, right? So you just measure a DC voltage here between the inner and the outer edge, and you compare with the experiment. In theory, you could be able to measure the viscosity, but you know, when I told this to experimental colleagues, they looked at me very badly. I felt really miserable, and you know, I just decided to, you know, think about something else.
What's the viscosity term in the equation in the last slide?
There's none, in the sense that this equation is just, you know, the time perturbation you are applying, right? Then, you know, we put this perturbation inside the Navier-Stokes equation, keeping nonlinearities up to second order, and we solve with the boundary conditions I mentioned, and you find the DC voltage between inner and outer ring as a function of the frequency omega of the time-dependent magnetic flux, and there is a qualitative feature there because of viscosity. So the DC voltage delta U would be totally independent on the frequency of the applied threading field, but because of viscosity in the kilohertz range, there is in fact a substantial dependence on the frequency of the external threading flux because of the shear viscosity. So that's more or less the idea, but I didn't talk about that. Yeah. So you're relying on the hydrodynamic nonlinearities to just to make the life of your experimental colleagues better, in the sense that it's very easy in condensed matter to measure DC voltages, and so we rely on that, and we just do it. This was, you know, put forward by Diakonoff and people in the 90s about, you know, treating perturbative with the Navier-Stokes equation just by including nonlinearities order by order in perturbation theory. And if you do a second order, you know, that's the calculation with it technically.
Can you explain again the advantage of plasma damping measurements?
Sure.
The measurement. How Corbino is.
Oh, no, sorry, I'm sorry. They are totally unrelated. I mean, so here, you know, we were relying on launching some plasmons, as you know very well, with the tip of an AFM. You know, no plasmons are involved in the Corbino disk geometry physics, as far as I understand. In that particular geometry, plasmons don't play any role.
How is Corbino experiment better than
plasmon damping? The experiment was not done, so I don't have the answer to your question. I mean, I'm saying these experiments of looking carefully at the plasmon lifetimes have been done, and the plasmon lifetimes is about 1 picosecond. So there's no way that has been done in these terahertz range, and so it's this is absolutely subdominant mechanism. That's the only thing that I can say, and so that's why we just. Forgot, because even in intrinsic samples, which are encapsulated, still you can scatter off acoustic phonons, and that's much more efficient to damp a collective mode than the viscosity. So,
could you say a few words about what the thoughts in the mind of your experimental colleagues were when they were giving a certain look like that?
Dirty Hook was about the Corbino, and so, you know, how do you do it in practice? So we told them crazy things, right? We told them, you know, take a wire and you stick a wire through the, I mean, Andy probably can comment on that, but, you know, doing a time-dependent flux, in an actual lab is I don't think it's so easy. I mean, I discussed with several people. It can be done potentially. Yeah, but you have to worry about several effects. If you're going to generate magnetic fields, you have to, and that's, you know, carefully done in the supplementary material of this paper, self-inductance. So it's not, you know, it's not quite clean. But anyway, no, but I mean, I discussed with Andre during this guy during this one of these graphene workshops. I told him about this, and you know, it's a very special guy. So it's not easy. I don't think it's an easy experiment to do, right? So there's a much easier way of doing this. So that's where we finally got, and this is the easy experiment is doing what's called the non-local transfer, right, in condensed matter. So you, and this was discussed by Leonid. So typically you get very simple device shaped into this gray shaded, that's a top view ideally of an encapsulated graphene sheet, and these square little things are just electrical contacts. You can put as many as you want, so you almost do can almost do transport experiments with lateral spatial resolution, right? With if you're very patient, which I find it absolutely amazing. And so you can do experiments of this type, right? So you flow current between one and two. Your current bias is sampled by forcing current to flow between one and two. And if you would measure the resistance drop between these two inner loop probes, that's the conventional four-point resistivity, rho xx, that we were talking about. Right? So that's called ordinary longitudinal transport. I will attach the term local for that type of measurement, which is absolutely crucial, because there are two parameters in the theory, right? There's tau, and there is the shear viscosity. So the theory has only two parameters. The rest, it's completely known. So if instead of looking at the potential drop between these inner loop contacts here, you probe slightly away from the current injection path, whereby slightly I'm just, it depends on scale, length scale, over which momentum diffuses, of course, right? If you have an edge state in your sample, which is propagating for 1 kilometer without dissipating, you can measure literally meters away from the injection path. But that's why we call this vicinity, right? Not truly non-local in the sense that, three has to be quite close to one. How much close? It depends on the theory. Within this simple Navier-Stokes approximation, we roughly have to be square root of nu tau, which is a length scale, away from the injection contact. And that's, so there are two delicate things here. First of all, in condensed matter, especially in the low temperature regime, once you, the base temperature of the cryostat increases, typically start from low temperatures, you have to worry about ballistic contributions, so single particle effects, which involve electrons shooting everywhere, which are very well known in condensed matter to give negative non-local resistances. So you have to be careful about that. And this special arrangement of contacts does the role we like, in fact, of being really very little susceptible to ballistic contributions. The second thing is that you have to fine-tune distances here and the size of your contacts and the distance between 1 and 3 to be able to measure potential non-local voltage drops between, let's say, 3 and 4 in response, in linear response to an applied current I. So many samples were studied, and in fact, the first one, it's a theory picture. The first one was a single layer graphene, and the second one was bilayer. Bilayer, by the way, I didn't have time to show that, it was not shown during the talk, has a completely different microscopic physics, right? The band structure is that of a chiral, it's a two bands that touch at these Dirac points in a quadratic fashion. So it's a quadratic band touching rather than a linear band touching. Much more subtle to many body physics, and many people in the audience have done calculations. You have very nice spontaneous symmetry breaking of different nematicity and so on and so forth. So the underlying physics is technically completely different, at least at low temperatures.
So with regard to your contact separation, if you're going to try and use in the single layer graphene to use those voltage contacts to measure the momentum relaxing mean free path, you're also going to be very susceptible to ballistic effects there if you don't manage to get them much more separated than the microscopic mean free path. No?
But in rho xx, in the longitudinal transport geometry, they don't show up. So it's absolutely no problem about that. I think if I understand your question, you're worried about ballistic contributions to rho xx.
Yeah. None.
In these particular configurations, I don't think there's none to rho xx, and that would be my answer, so there's nothing to worry about. In fact, I will show you ordinary resistance rho xx, which increases with temperature as the acoustic phonon model predicts. So okay. So the second sample was, as I said, bilayer. Technically, the underlying microscopic physics is quite different. And so these are the samples, amazing samples, that were built in Manchester with many probes. They are encapsulated. There are even top gates here to, although you're working in the Fermi-liquid regime, you would like to screen any potential inhomogeneities that are there, even in 10 to the 12. There's something out there. So you may be even doing, just be extra care in screening weakly weak inhomogeneities in the samples. And so this is the bilayer samples. And these are rho xx that I was talking about, so ordinary local longitudinal measurement as a function of tau. You can extract, as a function of temperature for different densities. You see that this is monotonically increasing as a function of temperature. This is an important point here, both in single layer and in bilayer. You may, you know, say that the crossover between ballistic low temperature and viscous transport is a little bulge in these curves, which is quite interesting.
How come the bilayer and the single layer has to have the lead configuration be different in the last slide?
No, this is, you know, so the only thing you need are these side contacts, and the spacing is important, and you can make 25 million, so you can make 6 or 7. It's not very important. If the physics would depend, like ballistic physics does, sensitively on the spatial arrangements of the contacts, it would be a little hard. So there's nothing special about placing them. The only thing you need is, there will be a current injector here, and there is a voltage probe there. That's what we are going to do. So you measure potential difference between this point and drain here, and you drive current between this contact and this contact, for example, in the bilayer geometry that I'm going to discuss, simply because it's a little easier with little less contacts for the modeling. So these are raw data without any manipulation. So these are maps, right? In one axis there is density here. In the other axis there is just temperature in Kelvin. This is for the single layer sample. This is for the bilayer sample. Just note that this is just, you know, this is going to -2 whole density, about 2.2, 2.3 in 10 to the 12 and not up to 3. So these are the raw data, right? So what you see in the raw data, it's quite amazing. You see that essentially, for every carrier density, away from the neutrality point at least, as you increase the temperature, there is a window, right, of temperatures, let's say, you know, above 70 Kelvin or so, in which these measured non-local resistance is negative. Right, and it switches back sign again to be positive at very large temperatures. Right. And see, this is what happens also in bilayer. So what's causing this, right? If, you know, careful rule out simply single particle effects and ballistic effects, which you can do in a variety of experimental and theoretical ways, is one simple explanation for this data. And the explanation is the following. You start from the low temperature regime where there is ballistic transport. And in this particular configuration of contacts, you have ordinary sign for the resistance. And then this first thing is beyond our current theoretical capabilities, is essentially a crossover, and this was mentioned by Leonid, which has a full quantum kinetic theory, so he can do that. But this first switch in sign is essentially entering the hydrodynamic regime. The idea is that there are two contributions to resistance, one which is associated with the viscosity, so this non-local resistance, and one which is associated to tau. The first sign change is due to the crossover from the ballistic to the hydrodynamic regime. The second is a much more easy crossover, is the crossover between the hydrodynamics and the simple ohmic transport, in which the temperature depends of tau, and the ohmic transport contribution is so much larger than the viscous one that dominates again. So it's a competition between two effects. In fact, the ohmic transport, you can calculate exactly for the sample geometry. That was something that you can do, and you can just subtract it off, and you can see that these negative contributions persist very well up to room temperature. It's just that here, it's not strong enough to cancel cancel the ordinary ohmic contribution. So minimal theory of this, this is a very nice Michelin star restaurant. If you come visit in Pisa, I will bring you there. So it's an amazing, this amazing piglet from Spain that they cook. I was told that, you know, this is recorded, so I cannot do the usual politically incorrect jokes. I'm trying to do politically correct, politically correct jokes. So two equations, steady state transpose is divergence of the current is zero. In the linear response regime, of course, density changes and the compressibility of the electron liquid doesn't show up. We work in a system with uniform density, so the only thing which is subject here to this gradient is the spatial distribution of the drift velocity, of the fluid element velocity more precisely. And the second equation is just the linearized Navier-Stokes equation, steady state Navier-Stokes equation, right? And so the theory, as I said, has two parameters. There's a crucial length scale that you can cook up very easily, and it's a root nu tau. Its physics will become clear in just a second. Just a comment was made on Reynolds number, and these experiments, if you put numbers in, estimating what is the drift velocity near the injection point, sampled with the viscosity we know a posteriori, and you put numbers in, we're working at Reynolds number 10 to the minus 3. So we do believe that just working with ordinary currents a little larger than, this was 0.1 microamp injection current. If you work at larger currents, it's no problem in reaching Reynolds number of order 1, 5, and, you know, interesting stuff happens there. So just to show you, we can do crazy things because we can, I will show you geometries in which you can solve the problem by Fourier transform. If you assume that the sample is translational invariant in the x direction, then you change everything into first order differential equations, and you can solve everything analytically by modeling, the injector as a simple delta function contact. But, we have put these on a code, so we can do just, solve this differential equation in codes. And so you can play with constrictions, you can play with rough boundaries here in your samples. We are even doing just a viscous flow in Sierpinski carpets, just for those. There is a motivation. It's not totally just because, but there is a motivation we can talk about later for those of you who are interested. They are not so crazy. So a few physical facts after you solve these equations. I think these are, well-established facts, at least in our opinion. These are the following facts. First of all, if you work in the linear response regime and you use no slip boundary conditions, we do believe that you should get, because of friction at the boundary, even a state of, you are always coupling to shear viscosity. So we do believe that the ordinary, if you do a calculation, that's what you find. Rho xx depends on the viscosity, even for a state of ordinary transport between source and drain without these lateral electrodes, right? So because of friction at the boundary and the fact that the velocity profile along the y direction progressively as viscosity increases become more Poiseuille flow, then you get even rho xx that depends on the viscosity nu, and therefore there should be a trivial non-monotonic temperature dependence of rho xx. That's a Gourgi effect, which was mentioned, the fact that the resistance technically should decrease as a function of temperature in a certain ranges of temperatures, and that's simply not seen in the data. That's why we use these no stress or free surface boundary conditions. In that case, a state of uniform flow applying a voltage, current bias between source and drain will give you rho xx, which is completely insensitive to shear viscosity, and therefore a monotonic temperature dependence. So that's more or less the idea. We do find, for reasons that were mentioned also by Leonid, of course, sign changes in the 2D electrostatic potential, because that has a viscous contribution, which is responsible for these sharp sign changes near the injector point. I should say that there was, discussions and some disagreement, because if you read our paper, we say that, these changes in sign in the local resistance are associated with vortex vortex formation in real space. I will comment a little bit more about that. It really depends, in our opinion, on the geometry, and for the geometry we are studying, we do believe that there is backflow, so current flowing back towards the injector, even for very small, arbitrary small values of the viscosity. And finally, again, in our samples, we do believe that these current vortices that I will show you in just a second are there. And so technically, you can, you know, there are now capabilities. Amir, for example, Harvard, has a very nice way of measuring tiny magnetic fields. So in theory, you could do either scanning probe potentiometry and measure locally the spatial dependence of the potential. This can be done. But you also can do scanning probe magnetometry and measure near these vortices. Measure the out-of-plane component of the magnetic field, so this can be done.
How large is this vortex?
I will show you in just a second. I will just show you, and that's the point we were trying to make. So this was, you know, mentioned by Falkovich here at the Perimeter Institute. This is a comment you can find online, and Leonid also mentioned this. It's a very, very nice, simple mathematical model that you can solve exactly, which is injection into a half plane with the boundary conditions are just on the x-axis. You can solve this totally analytically. If you zoom around here, the injection point, you find the totally radial velocity pattern with these sign changes of the potential. So it's not mathematically that to have sign changes in the electrostatic potential, which is the color plot, you don't necessarily need the backflow towards the injector, right? But this is the solution for our geometry, which we call vicinity geometry. So as I said, you inject here and collect current far away at drain. So the current is forced to do here this path, and then we measure potential difference between X bar and X bar plus D. And also this problem can be solved completely analytically without the aid of any computer, at least with no with free surface boundary conditions. And we see that what happens is that the spatial distribution of current, which is the vector field here, has vortices. And so in fact there are vortices which form here. So this W is units of the width of the all bar. So you can see there are vortices and backflow of current because of viscosity, you know, which are happening near the injector. And just the value of the viscosity sets precisely the spatial width of the vortices. So for typical experiments, in fact, there is a threshold by which really the vortex extends out to infinity. So it's backflow all the way if you cross this threshold value. And the experiments have done all the way, I should say, between a regime of very low viscosity, because you can change viscosity by temperature, of course. So this would be more a high temperature. This would be a lower temperature regime. So, and then it all depends on really where you place your contact. But at least near the injector, even for arbitrary small values of the viscosity, we do find vortices. So at least in this all bar geometry. And so you can have fun, and you can just do this even in the computer with really all the electrodes, which are the green things, putting metallic constant equipotential boundary conditions. Is really very, very simple. It can be done, and this again plots as a function of increasing viscosity going up all the way. This is no viscous regime, but the potential difference between source and drain, it's actually positive, and then you have the sign changes that were mentioned earlier. So, yeah.
Is it clear that these solutions are stable?
Stable against which perturbations, right? What happens when you increase current?
If you include time dependence.
These, I don't know whether you can prove stability of these as a function.
I mean, I think you're deep in this so-called creep flow limit. So I'd be very surprised if
it means stability. Yeah. It all depends, however, on how long you wait, right?
And also the relaxation.
Oh, of course, yeah, that's something, that's absolutely something that we keep forgetting. We are not used in classical water to have 1/tau there. In fact, it's not even clear. There were, several people that showed these nice plots by Sauro, Succi, and co-workers, in which people were showing turbulent, pre-turbulence at least. There was no 1/tau in those simulations.
I haven't bothered.
Okay. We can discuss about that, and of course there's no one with tau there. There's no electrostatics. So you have to be careful about this. I don't know how to answer your question properly. We have checked, of course, what happens with the as a function of increasing current approaching Reynolds of order 1 and 4, and that you can do solutions of this Navier-Stokes equation with a convective term till they converge self-consistently. It's actually kind of fun. So. But this is the most important point. It's called what we call, calibration curve, very technical, but it's how you extract the viscosity, right? So the point is the following. So we know that from longitudinal transport and rho xx within this model, you are sensitive only to tau. So if you have a map of rho xx or resistance as a function of carrier density and tau, you can build a map of the Drude-like tau. Very good. Then we need to extract the viscosity. So you need just a theory that tells you how this non-local resistance, in this case in units of the Drudian conductivity sigma naught, depends on viscosity, which is on the axis here, this square root of nu tau, in fact, nu tau. And so you can do this in a variety of ways. I think you can read here, but if you do this translational invariant analytical approximation, which there are no boundaries, and just the injector with modeled with a delta function potential, you get these field circles. The full numerical solution is the solid black line. These are all for free surface boundary conditions. If you want to check how these non-local signals depend on boundary conditions, the no-slip boundary condition is instead red squares, right? So then it's done, right? You have a system of two equations in two unknowns, because the experimentalist give you the map rho xx as a function of carrier density and temperature, and the maps I was showing you earlier of the voltage, the non-local RV as a function of the carrier density and temperature, and you have to invert a system of two equations in two unknowns, right? And that's absolutely, that's as simple as that, and just by inverting that you make maps of the Drude-like tau as a function of n and t, which I will not show, and you may make maps of the viscosity as a function of density and tau, right? So that's all we are doing. And so just to reiterate, in fact, the analytical work shows just the sum of these two contributions, the ohmic contribution, which just depends on tau, and the viscous contributions. And these coefficients for our geometry are actually
now. What's on the x-axis?
This is a nu, essentially, nu tau in microns. So d nu was square root of nu tau. It's the vorticity diffusion length. So it's just a length scale, square root of nu tau.
What's tau?
Oh, tau is the momentum non-conserving scattering time, which was the 1 over tau in the Navier-Stokes equation for modeling momentum non-conserving collisions, right? Okay, so these are the results for the for the kinematic viscosity nu of the electron liquid in single layer and bilayer graphene in the temperature range where we do believe you're deep into the hydrodynamic regime. And so these are the data with the wiggles are the experimental data. I don't see here my beloved gray vertical bars. If you look at the original paper and it's not showing up in this screen, there are safety gray bars there that we put near the neutrality point. You have to be honest, for the reasons Andy mentioned, of course, this theory is highly incomplete, works only in the Fermi-liquid regime. You have to do much more sophisticated stuff to have complete theory of hydrodynamic transport near the neutrality point. So the gray bar has disappeared. And the dashed lines are really microscopic calculations of the stress tensor response function for the electron liquid in the Fermi liquid regime. So so it's much simpler Feynman diagrams with respect to the one we saw today, but you have to do it completely non-perturbative in the strength of electron-electron interaction. So there's no parameter, the traces just depend on alpha, and I'm pretty happy with that, between the comparison between the calculated viscosity and the experimental data data extracted from this solution or 2x2 system. Of course, it's you know, improvements can be made, and we don't understand honestly where the discrepancies are coming from, and we don't fully understand where the discrepancies are coming from. I should be very honest about that, okay? So let me now conclude, just telling you also a little bit. I wanted to
remind us what the discrepancies are.
Oh, yeah. So I was just mentioning. So you see the wiggly points here are the kinematic viscosity extracted from the experimental data plus the Navier-Stokes modeling, which has nu and tau, right? And then we compare this with analytical calculations of the stress tensors, so really of the hydrodynamic zero frequency viscosity for the massless Dirac and the band touching model. So these are really honest, with no fitting parameter calculations of the viscosity of the electron liquid in single layer and bilayer.
How about the tau, the tau, how does that work out? The tau,
if you extract the tau from rho xx and this procedure I was mentioning, you find the tau which decays as a function of carrier density and temperature, as it should for this graphene scattering of electrons against acoustic phonons. So there's nothing there. It's the tau you would calculate from, honestly, it compares rather well, I should say, with the tau you would extract from simple Boltzmann transport calculations when you do scattering of electrons against acoustic phonons. So we there's nothing dramatic that you see in tau.
Looking at that plot, for single layer graphene, it seems like when you have, you're away from the neutrality point, your viscosity that's measured is much smaller than what's computed. That's true.
And I cannot say anything about that, honestly. So.
And what is your viscosity, E8 over S?
I didn't even dare doing that, right? Because I honestly didn't. Honestly, you know, I don't have a number. Also, because S, where do you take it from? Just simple calculation for free. Yeah, you can do that. Yeah, I didn't do this. Honestly, I didn't do this. I didn't want to push too much. Well, I don't know how far you will be from the 1/4 pi. Honestly.
If you plot the experimentally reduced viscosity as a function of temperature over the range where you think you can measure it, how does it look? Did you show that?
I didn't show that. Probably it's not in the paper. It's not in the supplementary material. I don't remember. I have it somewhere in my computer. It just looks what you would expect to look. Viscosity that decreases with a certain power law as a function of temperature for a given density.
But
I mean,
is it the expected power law? Is it the strongest?
So theoretically, if you do the calculation, at least with this, in the Fermi liquid regime, we find viscosity that decreases like T^-3/2. And as a function of temperature, that's what you find for within these calculations. You find viscosity that viscosity that it's like 1/T², like Abrikosov and Kolatnikov, at low temperatures, but then decreases with a different power law. We find roughly from fits. You can calculate this on the computer, and then you fit it, and it seems T^-3/2, the decay of the viscosity as a function of temperature.
But that's all calculation. What about the experiment?
I don't have those plots here in my talk, but you do find, I don't remember how good it's the comparison there. Absolutely. No, you're right. And yeah, we can look at that. I should have it in my computer so we can discuss about that.
What if remove the no-slip boundary condition? Would it help to...
No, in our opinion, for the reason profound is a big word after the talk by Subir this morning, but so we found that rho xx would simply be non-monotonic as a function of temperature, which is not seen in the experimental data. Sure, you can interpolate between the two boundary conditions, but for any boundary scattering length LB finite, you would find that there is an admixture in rho xx of a shear contribution to rho xx, and that would give you, non-monotonic, behavior. Perhaps it explains a little bulges we were talking about, but we didn't, the easier. There would be a third parameter in the theory, right, which is the boundary scattering length, and we didn't feel in introducing a third parameter, honestly.
Okay.
And also, how come in the experimental data is not so symmetric on the?
Okay, this is problems of electron hole inhomogeneities, which are even there. That's why the Manchester group even put a top gate on single layer, which is of course useless. That if you have technically, if you have single layer to the electron system, then you can just use one gate to change density. Right, it's by layer that you have a much more rich stuff when you do dual gated samples. So the top gate there was made to screen these inhomogeneities. They are there; it's unavoidable, and at least that's our understanding. I don't have anything deep to say about these electron hole asymmetries. Right, they are seen in many transport experiments. They're seen in STM all the time. Can be residual coupling to Coulomb impurities far in the silicon dioxide. I honestly don't have a clue. Although you definitely see that it's much weaker, the electron hole asymmetry, when you go to bilayer. And so we don't know whether that's because of screening one layer with respect to the other layer. And it's known, right? It's a little more less susceptible to electron hole inhomogeneities and bilayer samples. So. Okay, let me tell you just, I wanted to spend also a few minutes telling you what we are doing. So I also don't like Andy, I like this remark, you don't like to read conclusions myself. I hate reading conclusions. We are just, so that's what we are more or less doing nowadays. So we are like really having fun with Lidl logic fluidic devices. So we have found amazing things. There was a military company in the US in the 60s. They were very worried about nuclear warfare. And so, they said, let's invent little devices that operate universal, classical computation and all sorts of possible gates by using water and classical liquids. Right? There was an entire group at MIT I found in some lab of MIT which do logic computations by using bubbles, nitrogen bubbles in water, and they are perfectly able to do logic universal computation. So just for fun, there's one student playing with creating all sorts of hydrodynamic and it would be not useful in still electrons. It would be much faster than water, but it would be not useful in a nuclear warfare context. And it's funny because you can do this. It's, you find that current interactions already at Reynolds 1 are enough to give you a decent fault-tolerant classical computation with hydrodynamic electron liquids. That's for fun. Talking about a little bit more serious stuff, we are revisiting, in fact, with Miller, Mendoza, and Sauro, we are revisiting this early work they did just to incorporate this physics we do understand better now with respect to their original works, trying to understand what happens at perturbulence when, in theory, you drive a large current. It's not the only nonlinear effect, of course, there, but it's one we would like to understand a little better, the convective nonlinearity effect. And for us, it would be interesting to understand data and magnetic field. If you put, the Lorentz force and in the Navier-Stokes equation, you just get the classical Hall effect, and you don't get quantum oscillations. So, and the samples show in magnetic field all the time transverse magnetic focusing, which is semi-classical, and you see Shubnikov the gas oscillations in magnetic field. And so it's not that you just take magnetic field and put it into Navier-Stokes equation. And so it's not like in a plasma. So we have to do something better, probably resorting to, to a quantum kinetic equation. I'm not sure, honestly, about that. Definitely something, that's something I wanted to mention, because perhaps I've seen always conductivity activities in this workshop evaluated at zero momentum and finite frequency at best. I would just wanted to mention now there's lots of activities in the world led by a variety of groups, Dmitry Basov in the US and Frank Oppens and Rainer Hillenbrand in Europe, in Spain, in which you can actually measure for the first time, at least for two-dimensional crystals, you can measure for the first time the full non-local conductivity, sigma of Q and omega, finite wave vector, which I do find amazing, in fact. And it requires some work. They are getting there. And the technique is extremely simple, very elegant, right? So you just have a metallized tip. And that's the tip of an AFM. You shine infrared light on it, right? And you launch collective modes, right? So in graphene, these are just plasmons. very, very simple plasmon modes that you launch, and they reflect off the boundaries of a pattern sample. They go back into the tip. The plasmon is back converted into into light, and then you have just a photon detector, right? And so the momentum resolution is given, of course, by the tip. The tip has a radius of curvature roughly 20, 25 nanometers, and that gives you a characteristic wave vector Q, right, of order 1 over 20. I find it amazing. So you can map out the full dispersion relation of collecting modes. So I was wondering whether that's of use to do investigations in strongly correlated materials or more exotic collecting modes than ordinary plasmons. And that's something, something that is very interesting in my opinion. Okay, so the hope is, of course, to measure with terahertz or gigahertz. Terahertz light, really, to measure viscosity by using this. This new device, new apparatus. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention. Thanks.
Questions?
I have a question about the show water system you showed.
Oh, yeah.
Here. So for the one on the lower left, what were the boundary conditions that you used?
So all of these is non-slip. Sorry, all of this is free surface. I apologize. All of this is free surface boundary conditions.
Free surface meaning?
Free surface meaning no stress.
Zero stress.
Zero stress boundary conditions.
So we did calculation for the boundary conditions and found very different behavior. There is a vortex, but it weaves not where you have it, but way outside.
Okay, so I can. So it really depends on the geometry, as I said. So it really depends, strictly speaking, on the geometry you're using.
Same geometry, of course.
With same geometry of injector and collector. Okay, so let me be very precise about that, because we do find exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So let me just be very, very precise when I answer that, okay? Okay, so these vortices located near the injector or a reasonable distances are found exactly for this specific geometry, right? So these are fully analytical calculations, so x0 is sent to infinity, and this is the injector. If we change, for example, if we put these two electrodes, one in front of each other, in what we call the Levitov and Falkovich geometry, in this preprint here, absolutely, you need, so that the vortex appear at infinity, so we do find also that very far away for those numbers I was giving of the viscosity. I think there's pretty much in agreement. But for this geometry, they do appear near the injector. So, and this is analytic. That's why we wanted to do analytical calculations without, of course, the code gives the same thing, but we wanted to do completely analytical calculations. I really trust these results. So, but we do find effects like the one you were mentioning, just slightly changing the arrangements of the contacts.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Marco again.
Thank you.